This episode of Keep Calm and Cook On is presented by Great Jones. Great Jones is a line of beautiful, last-you-a-lifetime cookware that's priced well and comes in great finishes and colors. To find out more about Great Jones, head over to greatjones.com. And for 15% off of any purchase on greatjones.com, use the code CALM. That's C-A-L-M. My guest today is Lagusta Yearwood, who founded Lagusta's Luscious, an artisanal vegan chocolate company, in 2003. Over the last 16 years, she has grown the chocolate business into three brick and mortars, a chocolate shop and a cafe in New Paltz, New York, and a sweets shop in Manhattan's East Village. She also just came out with a brand new cookbook called Sweet and Salty, The Art of Vegan Chocolates, Truffles, Caramels, and More. Lagusta came over to my house recently to talk about her businesses, her book, the magic of making candy at home, the complication of operating a business while also questioning capitalism, the power of listening to your employees and developing systems, knowing how and when and why to grow, and how to navigate working with friends. Note that my dogs and Lagusta's dog played a bit while we spoke, so you might hear a bark or two. And also, before I forget, head to my Instagram post about this episode. It's the photo of Lagusta with her dog for a chance to win one of 5 copies of Lagusta's new book. And if you enjoy our conversation, be sure to check out Lagusta's podcast called Thanks in Advance, which I've linked to in the show notes. Okay, without further ado, I hope you enjoy our conversation. In your book introduction, there are, I feel like, a few of these like pivot points that I just thought were like really kind of amazing, and I wanted to talk about a few of them. And they were sort of more about your kind of like background and building your business and stuff. It's like that sort of more biographical part. But the first one that really struck me was this moment when your private chefing business has kind of grown, and it's before you've opened the chocolate shops and everything.
Yeah.
But this moment when you realize you need to hire more people. Yes. And I think that's like a moment that probably no matter what you do, whether you work like in food and chocolate and cookbooks in a completely different industry, I think a moment lots of people can relate to where it's like you've done as much as you can on your own. And then that sort of feeling of expanding but also wanting to hold on to control and details. And that's such a tough point. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that moment in your life and kind of how you knew it was time to bring someone else on or a couple of people on.
Yeah, it's. I feel like I've been through that point like at 5 different times, and they've all been so painful. I mean, at one point, I literally just left work, checked into a hotel in New Paltz in my town, and stayed there overnight just to like sit and write in my journal about like, should I get smaller so I can work by myself, or should I get bigger so that I can provide jobs? And you know, it's I have this strange history where I never set out to have a business. So it's very different, I think, if you have a business plan and a timeline and a plan for growth. But I just wanted to make food, and then I wanted to make chocolate. So it's all grown very organically. And on top of that, I have these really annoying politics that are very anti hierarchical and very, you know, a very strong sense of feminism, and that breaking down power boundaries and you know, hierarchies is our job. So, you know, having to work through both of those things has taken me years. And I have to say, it is possible. I feel totally comfortable with where I'm at now.
That's amazing.
And I have like 35 employees, and I want more. I want to just grow, you know, grow the businesses.
Yeah.
And I've really come to realize, like, I've really come full circle with it. But it took just a lot of processing.
The fact that you say that's possible and that you're happy doing this, and you are, I can attest, smiling when you say that.
Yeah.
To me, that's pretty amazing because it sounds a little impossible. So could you kind of break down that magic a little?
I mean, I think honestly, a lot of it was listening to my employees. And in the beginning, good shake.
Including your dog.
In the beginning, we would do these funny things at the chocolate shop where we never took tips because I was like, this was right before restaurants really started changing the tip model. And I just didn't want to take tips because I felt like it was a gross exchange that made me feel not good. And that worked when it was just me. But then, you know, some of my employees were asking, like, why don't we take tips? And so we literally sat outside in a circle and talked about it. And finally, someone who worked at the chocolate shop, she just said, but taking tips means more money that we can use to pay bills. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, let's take tips. You know, it was like, it's one thing for all of my like highfalutin feminist ideals, but it's another of we're in the world we're in,
yeah.
You know? So I've really learned to grow from like in the beginning, I wouldn't give my employees a lot of direction and it would be very much like, oh, I don't know if you want to make it this way, make it this way. And no one likes that,
yeah.
You know? I mean, some people like that, the people who are probably going to go and own their small business in a couple of years, you know? But I've really come to realize that a lot of people want to do well at a job mm-hmm. and they want direction in order to do a good job. So my work is really teaching them how to do well. And so I've had to just really have a lot more systems and a lot more, honestly, rules
yeah.
and procedures so that we can all succeed. And now it's kind of this system where it doesn't feel like I'm enforcing a kind of meanness on people. It's just, I mean, the cafe that I own, it's just pretty cut and dried. Like, it's very busy and you either are the kind of person who can work there or you're not. And I've really separated that from, like, I don't judge people. If, you know, sometimes we trial people there and it doesn't work out. And it used to be kind of, I would be like, what's wrong with them? Why can't they do this job?
Mm.
You know, and now I'm just like, I don't think you're suited to this.
Yeah.
And that's nothing against you at all. You know, very few people can work, honestly, in the food industry at all. So I guess just things like that of like really consciously analyzing how I'm running things and seeing that I'm not running them with like love of power or money at the heart, you know? So, and now, I mean, one reason I want to grow a little bit and expand is because I want to make more profit so that I can provide better jobs for my community.
Yeah.
You know, I live in a college town and I have a lot of people who have hourly jobs and I want to start providing salary jobs, you know? And I think in the old, like more, I don't know, pure me would be like, you know, I don't know, say something about how being a boss is bad. But now I'm like, what's bad about providing jobs that people enjoy and trying to make more money so that they can have a living wage?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just kind of started seeing things in a more realistic way. And it really helped me break down a lot of my like resistance.
What would you say is at the heart of what you do? Like,
oh,
you said, what isn't, but what is? Yeah.
Yeah. I think about that a lot. And it's something that we talk about, like when new people start, I teach a little class about like, what is this business about?
Like you teach that to new employees?
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, and I want to take the class.
I know.
No, but
it's really
not
fun. Okay. I really think that like, I mean, it's kind of a variation of like this little talk that I give sometimes about like being a business owner with a heart.
Mm.
And it really is just to me to push my values within the capitalist system as much as I can. And I really think about it in terms of a kind of really good like Robin Hood,
yeah.
In that like people entrust me with their money that they work so hard for, and they're buying something from us that they, you know, believe in. And it's a big responsibility to sell someone a $10 chocolate bar or a $12 chocolate bar. So I feel like, you know, being able to take that money and buy chocolate that is grown ethically and harvested, you know, well, and use local ingredients and things like that, it's really just to like show that you can have a business that doesn't compromise, or that doesn't compromise all the time. We
yeah.
have to make compromises sometimes, and really just go for it. And I started out life as an activist, so I'm always trying to like get back to that sort mm-hmm. of. And yeah, I think honestly, it's going. There's
yeah.
a lot more we could be doing, but I'm pretty happy with where we're at.
Yeah. So you're happy with where you're at, but you also mentioned wanting to expand more. And there was a line I wrote down, one of these other pivot points, which I thought was really interesting. You said the more efficient we get, the bigger we get, and I don't want to get much bigger.
Yeah.
But you didn't say you don't want to get bigger, just not much
yeah.
bigger. So tell me about that kind of like knowing your sort of boundaries and like knowing
yeah.
how big is too big or how small is too small. Like I think that's, again, something that no matter what you do, like many of us can kind of relate to. Like,
yeah.
you know, I think we live in this culture that's, as you talk about so much in the book, is, you know, it's so driven by capitalism. So it's like, how can this scale? How can this, you
yeah.
know, quadruple or whatever's more than quadruple,
you exactly.
know? Yeah. So tell me about that, like kind of the...
Yeah. That's something also, you know, the managers like of the chocolate shop and I, we talk about a lot because there's a lot of, it's funny. It's a question between how much are we just buying into the idea that bigger is better and how much are we trying? I mean, I know that like right now we can't really be as productive as we need to be because of lack of space. So I'm just, you know, looking at solving that problem. But then looking at solving that problem means, oh, if we move into a bigger space, then we need to do this and this and buy this machine. And then, you know, it just kind of all snowballs a little bit.
Yeah, more money, more problems.
Yeah. And I think the old me used to think like that was just buying into a sort of system that traps people. And then before you know it, you're, I don't know what, oppressing everyone. And but now, I don't know, maybe from going to therapy or just working on myself, I don't believe that growing a little bit more is all of a sudden going to turn me into someone who's just has no values.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I thought
that— Was
that
a fear for you
before?
Yeah,
I think just the fear that money means bad and making more money means that I'm a worse person. And there's a direct correlation between those two things. But I think when I started seeing it from the point of view of my employees, of making more money means I can provide healthcare and I can have paid vacations, I can't see a way that that's bad.
Yeah.
So I think that has really driven things. And I kind of try to come back to that. But I do, you know, I have a friend who had a business that got really big and it had national distribution. And she, the minute she started get her products getting distributed with like national distribution, her profit margin shrunk so much that she had to close. Like she was making more money than she'd ever made, but less profit she'd ever made. So I think, you know, I'm really, really conscious of how we market ourselves and how we sell things and just trying to like, I think the whole thing for me is about that we decide how we run the business, me and the people who work there, not outside forces.
Yeah.
So, and I think a lot of times people just get wrapped up in this is what you do next and this is how it goes. But it's really, I like that I can just have really honest conversations about, you know, why are we doing this?
Yeah.
What's happening?
I feel like so much of what you were talking about kind of like over and over is this like working in these moments to kind of press pause and sort of just like check in on how it's going, where you want it to go, this reflection you're doing on your own, but then also with your team or your teams.
Yeah.
And so is that something that you consciously, is that like in your schedule? Like, is that like, do you block out time or does that just happen organically? Like, what are the logistics of that kind of reflection?
That's a great question. I feel like I really like the big meta, big picture thoughts.
Yeah.
I think because I'm always... Honestly, I mean, it's still a relic of when I was like trying to decide if I was doing the right things all the time. Mm-hmm. So I think a little part of me, you know, I'll be driving and I'm like, is this what we want to do? You know, so like those thoughts come naturally to me. So I do have, we have like biweekly meetings with the managers at all the businesses because I have a chocolate shop, cafe, and then a shop in New York City. I really try to note on the agendas for those, kind of taking a minute to really pull back and look at those things. And I do wonder the extent to which people who aren't managers in the businesses, like, I don't know how much that kind of trickles down to them, not to use a Reagan-esque phrase, but, you know, so we do have staff meetings, too, or every other month where I try to talk about these big things. But I do think that it's funny running a business that's very consciously political because a lot of times you get people who want to work there because of the politics, and it always has to be... You know, it's great that you care about our politics, but you also have to be able to do the job. So that's kind of a funny contradiction we have sometimes. But, you know, I don't know. I'm interested in how all that stuff works.
Yeah.
So we just kind of talk about it and see how it goes.
Yeah. So speaking of all these people that you keep referencing, another big moment that stood out to me, I like literally wrote these down by hand. You were talking about, and this I thought was like a pretty like incredibly touching part of your introduction, maybe the part that's making some folks cry, as you mentioned, but when you talk about losing your mother and that moment in your life, and you talked about, you said, I didn't think the shop could function without me. And then it turns out the shop did for a while. And I'm wondering about that lesson of that your business, you've built it in this way that it can run without you there. I'm wondering if that lesson impacted anything else in your life. Did you feel that, to use that trickle down term? Like, did that affect you anywhere else?
Oh, yeah. It literally changed everything about my entire life. I mean, yeah, I think a lot of people who work for themselves are super obsessed with control and, you know, quality control.
I don't know what you're
themselves.
Talking about.
And, you know, it's like, I think to myself still like, oh, I wish I could plate every single dish at the cafe. And I miss that. And I see things that go out and I'm like, oh, I wouldn't have put the parsley there, you know, but I've just... Because my mom got sick and I took basically a year off taking care of her, I just, it was honestly the biggest gift that she ever gave me because, I mean, she gave me a lot of gifts by being my mom, but because it, I just didn't care at all about work, which had never, ever happened because I was so obsessed with productivity and, you know, growing the businesses and doing a great job at everything. And to be able to let that go was totally life-changing. And it really did change how I look at the business because it really, I mean, this, I love this aspect of being a boss where you kind of just pull back and people rise up to the occasion in amazing ways. We just had a situation like this at the chocolate shop where one of the managers just, it's kind of a very complicated story to go into, but we had a piece of machinery that was broken for like 3 years and she just took it on and, you know, started communicating with a company in Italy and, you know, just amazing. And I'd kind of given up on it because it was too stressful for me to deal with. And I was just blown away by, she was just like, I'm going to fix this. Yeah. And she did, you know, and that's kind of what happened that year that my mom was sick. Everyone, I mean, I can't, for people who work in the businesses now, it's like impossible to, I don't know, just like this podcast is for them. I hope they're all listening, but it's been impossible to explain how like I made all the chocolates, you know, like, I mean, and I had help, but now I make none of the chocolates, you know, it's like a 180 degree complete difference. And now that freed me up to really, one, live a little bit more of a life after working, you know, 15 hour days for 15 years. Now I work 12 hour days.
Look at you.
Better, but they're not production days, you know? So it's easier and it freed me to look at more big picture things and, you know, all kinds of things. So it really did, I mean, that and the grieving process, it really kind of remade me in much stronger ways, but also, I mean, horribly sad because I don't have a mom now.
Sure.
So, yeah. But I'm very grateful to that.
Yeah. I'm sorry about your mom.
Thanks.
It was really, it was like such a, you wrote about it really beautifully. Yeah.
She was great.
Yeah. It sounded that way. Do you miss making chocolate? You said you started this because you want to make chocolate. Yeah.
Yeah. I miss cooking and making chocolate, but I have a long-term plan for myself, which is kind of working on these growth plans for a couple of years. And then I kind of wrote myself a little job description, which is, honestly, just like doing things like foraging for ingredients for, you know, chocolate and herbs and things like that. And then kind of going back to like creating chocolates more and maybe not being like in production. But right now I'm not really in the headspace for that, but I want to kind of get back to it. And it makes me feel good to have a plan.
Yeah.
I love a good plan.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I get that. So you talked about like you love being a boss for those reasons. And I had
I can't believe I said I love being a boss. I just want to acknowledge how much, how much
I think
I've
you
grown.
Did, right?
I think I did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Whew.
So I have a kind of a flip side question about that. So for anyone who might, you know, have super strong values as you do, they don't have to be the same values,
but
I think
good if they were.
Yeah, that'd be great. What do you think about someone who feels like they want to do work that aligns with their values, but they don't necessarily want to be a boss? Like, you don't want to start the thing. You don't want to be in charge. You don't want to be an entrepreneur, but you want to have a job or, you know, a passion or a purpose, you know, something that occupies your time that aligns with those values, but you don't necessarily want to be the one to kind of like reinvent the wheel.
Yeah. I mean,
what do you
honestly
say to those folks?
I think that those are the people that I'm employing.
Yeah, you're like, I'll hire you.
Yeah, I'll hire you. But I think that one, you could work for yourself. And I think that now more than ever before, because of, which is maybe good or bad, how niche everything has gotten on the internet, you can really find the audience that really responds to your values. Hopefully great ones of tolerance and stuff. But And also just, I think people are much more open at talking to companies that they're applying for and applying to and really asking them about their ethical commitments. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's how things are going to change, is by being honest with companies that you work for or want to work for and just asking them, you know, I really want to work for a company that does these things. Is that something that you do? Mm-hmm. And maybe it'll cost you a job, but maybe it would cost you a job at a place that you really wouldn't want to work for.
Yeah. It's like that pause button again, just like asking.
Yeah. I mean, that said, like, I think it's really important to talk about privilege and how it is so privileged to be able to just have the choice of where you work, you know, and that I try really hard. I mean, we make these such like fancy products that aren't meaning to be fancy, but they are because of the ethics pushes the price up. Mm-hmm. And I think that you have to really, if you have deep politics, hand in hand in that has to be not judging people who can't afford those products or don't know anything about the like ethical chocolate, you know, because if you're working three jobs to survive and at the end of the day you want a Snickers bar, I have nothing bad to say to you, you know? So I try to always like pull myself back and look at that. So, but yeah, that was meandering.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's great. The sort of like pulling back and looking at things, like a few times you referred to like old you and how you would have responded to things. You mentioned therapy. I'm just kind of wondering, is the line between like old you and you now, was that losing your mom? Was it therapy? Was it something else? Like,
yeah.
Is there like a clear distinction?
Oi, getting in. Well, yeah, I mean, since you asked, I had a really bad childhood. And so I think it took me years after that childhood to even start to think about it. Mm-hmm. And then after starting to think about it, was starting to be like, oh, maybe I'm not, maybe all these things I do for these reasons. Mm. And kind of, you know, and then it took me years to try to go to therapy. And, you know, it's been like a really slow process and of just unpacking all that stuff. And especially, I mean, I had a 20-year relationship end 2 years ago.
Wow.
So that was exciting. Yeah. And, you know, it led to a lot of personal growth also. And I think that because of that, since, you know, my mom died, relationship ended, starting like new businesses, and I've really just been a constant personal growth path. So it's really kicked up because I kind of had a nervous breakdown which is also written about in the book.
Yes.
The licorice recipe. When my relationship ended, and you know, I really started doing like the DBT workbook and all these mental health things that really helped me. So I feel it, you know, like I feel that I've put in the work and I feel it paying off every single day.
Yeah.
And just things like meditating, and I really have much more ability to kind of like watch my emotions instead of engage with them and all kinds of things like that. Wow.
Thank
Proud
you.
Of myself again.
No, thanks for sharing that. I appreciate it. And you do share so much in the book. And, you know, you were talking about like kind of watching your book be received and maybe in ways you don't necessarily expect. Do you, like, I know in my own cookbooks, like I share a lot of like super personal stuff and sometimes stuff where I'm like, oh, I wrote that? Whoa. Like,
yeah, it's
do
funny.
You feel that at all? Like, how is that
Always,
going for you?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I know for me, this is another thing that I can trace a direct line that my childhood was full of secrets. I mean, my dad was a drug dealer who was very abusive, and it was all about hiding things, you know, and all about like never answer a knock at the front door, you know, just things like that. And so for me, I feel a lot of freedom of telling everyone everything. And, you know, I mean, if I had my choice, I think my bookkeeper hates when I say this, I would just have all of our books out on the internet, you know, like all of our finances. Like, I just feel safety in saying things.
Yeah.
And it makes me feel a lot more free to know that everyone kind of knows everything. And then it feels like I'm not being judged, or, I mean, maybe I'm being judged. I don't know. So I think that, but it does surprise me sometimes when, you know, you write a cookbook like in a little cafe or at home and on your couch, and then all of a sudden people are like, oh, that thing. And you're like, oh gosh, that's weird.
Like, how do you know that?
Yeah,
oh, I told you.
Oh, I voluntarily put it out there.
Yeah.
But I think that for me, there is a lot of power in, you know, naming things and being open about them and really being like, okay, here's where we're at.
Yeah.
Just going forward with these things that have happened. And it helps me feel just much more I don't know, free in the day-to-day.
Yeah, I totally get that. I think the sort of like that, you know, whatever your bookkeeper would say, but sort of like being transparent about things like finances and stuff, like there's something about that that feels kind of radical to me
in
a culture that keeps so much of that so secret to kind of like keep certain people in power and stuff. And it's like, I think in the food industry, in the restaurant industry, definitely in the cookbook industry, like people don't tell each other like, how much was your advance? Or like these kinds of things. And it's like the more transparent they are, like we all are.
It helps everyone.
Yeah. There's that kind of like collective power and that kind of transparency.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we talk about that with like our wages. Like, you know, we're never just going to be like giving someone a huge raise. And, you know, we try to have like a good differential because I don't ever want to run a business where I'm scared that people will talk about what they make with each other, you know, because that just is a classic tool of the oppressors to keep everyone down.
Sure.
So, yeah.
What do you look for when you're hiring someone?
You know, it's interesting. We talk about that a lot because I think that on the one hand, I want to say like, I used to think you want to look for someone that you could be in a room with for 8 hours, which is definitely true. But I also think we need to really examine a kind of bias that we all inherently have of like, maybe then you're looking for a person who's just like you and who looks like you and, you know, has the same background as you or whatever. And especially in our town, which is very not diverse, it's something that we really kind of try to pull at a little bit. So, I mean, there's that, but it's a lot of different things. I don't know. And a lot of it, honestly, is intuition, which I think people are like afraid to say that they rely on.
Yeah.
But I think it's really important is because, you know, at this point, I think I've had like 100 employees over time because I keep a little list. I think it's at like 105. And I feel like at this point I have, you know, I can tell pretty quickly that someone's going to be good. And yeah, it's just like developing that sense.
Yeah.
And then also just when, you know, yeah, just challenging yourself to be like, why do I think this person's going to be good? You know, and kind of trying to grow from your, implicit bias that we all have or something.
How do you sort of, if you're valuing kind of like diversity in your staff, which I think is great, like do you do anything to kind of make your places of work, you have more than one, kind of more welcoming if there is like implicit bias? Like if you've built a place where it is like, maybe your instinct is like, oh, I want to hang out with this person for 8 hours because we have a lot in common. We have the same references. Maybe we have things in common. And if you're trying to bring people into that space that might not have those things in common, how do you make it attractive for them to come to you?
Yeah. I think I'm pretty bad at that. I really think that, and I've learned this from listening to my employees, you know, from listening to people of color who've worked in my businesses who've talked about how, you know, I mean, it's hard because I think it'd be very easy to say, I don't decide who comes in to the business. I don't decide who applies to the business. But I think it's much more complicated, you know? And I think the way that this has come out in the past is because of the playlist, you know? And
that's
like,
so interesting.
I mean, honestly, almost everyone that I employ hates the music that I want to play, which is like 90s Riot Girl, which is very off-putting to
everyone.
So yeah, I mean, you can't just have all Bratmobile playing at all times. So part of that is generational, you know, but there in the beginning, there were pretty, not a lot of bands with people of color in our playlist, you know, and so we've really worked on that. And I don't know. It's been a really interesting time of being like called out.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we had I don't know if I should call out Patti Smith, who I love, but we had Patti Smith in our playlist, and then someone who worked there. There's a song that has the N-word that Patti Smith sings. That's really bad. And I Googled around. She's never apologized for it. And I thought, okay, we took that song out. Problem solved. And then I had the employee called a meeting with me and was like, I really don't feel comfortable having any Patti Smith in the playlist. And it turns out, I don't think this employee had ever listened to Patti Smith, which that, like, at first I was like, you don't even know that Patti Smith is this leftist icon. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, that doesn't matter, you know? Like this person was really upset, and it is very upsetting, you know? The song is terrible. And, you know, so it's things like that where I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, Patti Smith is above reproach. And then it's like, not really.
Yeah.
Let's take the Patti Smith out of the playlist if it's making people feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So Yeah. So it's just things like that. But I don't know. I do think that there are a lot of like, I mean, we have this mitzvah wall at the cafe that is on the one hand really awesome because it's like you can buy something and put a little sign on the mitzvah wall that someone can come and redeem it, you know, and, you know, if someone's having a bad day, here's some soup or whatever.
And but, you can do it for like a specific person too, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
I'm going to Grace, my wife, gets $5 towards whatever. Like, it can be whatever you want.
Okay. And then we also have one sliding scale soup option. Mm-hmm. And honestly, sometimes it feels a little, I don't know, like self-congratulatory kind of. Because we do have people who come in, I'd say a couple customers, because I'm always kind of looking out for this, who I feel like know that if like it's kind of a short cash week for them, they can get that soup for like $2. And that's, you know, what it's for. But I do worry that sometimes it's like, oh, look at this fancy little cafe and like their little sliding scale thing.
Like a virtue signaling type of thing.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So I'm always trying to think about that. And I mean, I don't know. It's something that I want to continue growing and learning about.
Do a lot of people kind of take you up on the sliding soup scale? Sliding scale soup?
Yeah, I know it's hard to say.
Say that five times.
Yeah. Most in the beginning, I wanted everything to be sliding scale, but then it's honestly just too annoying to ring people up. It's kind of like in the beginning how I wanted my management style just to be, there's no rules, do whatever you want. Yeah. And now even asking that one question, it's like confusing to people. So, you know, we have a little speech of like, we have the soup is sliding scale. It's suggested price $6. And 95% of people pay $6.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, we have people who pay more or less, which is really nice.
So but the 5% left, some pay more, some pay less.
Yeah. And we don't have any numbers on if it's like worked out exactly. I guess we could look at those. but what I've noticed that I think is really interesting is the people who pay more are generally people who don't outwardly present as being more wealthy, but kind of seem like they have more politics, you know, which is probably what you'd think. So I don't know.
What's like the most a bowl has gone for? Do you know?
Ooh. Let me think. I think someone paid $20.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if anyone's done like $100. I don't think so.
That soup's really good.
Yeah, it's good.
I like it a lot. Do you have a favorite thing on your menu? Is that like a terrible question?
No. I mean, it's really funny. I have a least favorite thing. Not really. I mean, we make this really good mac and cheese that we've worked really hard on. And, you know, I mean, vegans are so funny because our menu's all vegan and people like travel to eat it. But I feel like I've eaten it too much, and so it just tastes like nothing to me.
Yeah.
So
it's
I'll
like when
see,
you say a
you
word
know,
too many times, and it like loses its meaning.
It's funny. I have it like twice a year now, and then I'm like, oh, this is pretty good. But yeah.
Just talking about your like employees and navigating all of that, one thing that kind of sticks out to me, because in the book, as you mentioned, like there are portraits of people who work at all the shops and everything. Like it is such a sort of celebration of community. You've used the word we like so many times. Yeah. And I'm just wondering, it seems like you are also quite friendly with like a lot of the people you work with. And some friends have worked for you. You've become friends with some of the people who work for you. And I find working with friends really difficult.
Yeah.
And it can be like amazing. And I've seen lots of examples in both kind of directions, like amazing, but also it can be terrible. And that just seems like an area to me that feels like a little sticky. And
definitely.
I'm wondering if you have any like, nonstick tips.
Well, it's strange how much it's changing because I'm getting older and working in a college town. Now I'm employing people who are like half my age.
Wow.
So I'm not like, hey, let's go to a movie.
Yeah.
You know, I think when I first started hiring people, like the first like three people I hired are all still like my best friends. And that has worked out really well, but it definitely has caused a lot of, drama over the years. But I think in the beginning, the job was just so much of my life that it just became that way, sort of. And now I'm much more conscious of having good lines, sort of, because I don't ever want anyone, you know, I mean, I know, like, things happen now of, like, all the, you know, lots of people will have a party and I'm not invited and, you know, maybe 6 years ago, I'd be like, oh, you didn't invite me to the party. And now I'm like, I'm not going to that party, you know? So I'm kind of more conscious of things like that. But it has worked out pretty well. I mean, I think I talk about in the book, I dated a manager at the shop and she and I are still best friends.
Yeah.
We work together every day. It was definitely really hard for a while. But I think also, like, honestly, I'm still really good friends with everyone I've ever dated. I just have a weird thing like that where once people are in my life, they're just there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been hard. I mean, my business partner at our shop in the city, we work together in the same space pretty much every day for like 10 years. And she just moved and opened a shop in Kingston, 20 minutes away. And it's really difficult not seeing her all the time. But we definitely get into like one or two huge fights a year.
Yeah.
So
that does have, it's not like all smooth sailing.
Yeah, yeah, no, definitely not at all. I mean, I'm, you know.
It's like human relationships.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think it's just, you're just, and I think also because I don't have family really, It really is like this tight bond. And not in a way of like new people start and I'm like, you're in my family, you know, because that would be really creepy. But definitely, but you know, and I see it happen too with, I don't know, quote unquote, the younger generation, where when I opened the cafe, everyone who worked there to start, we had a crew of, I think like 5 people. And within a couple months, they're all like living together, dating or best friends, you know, and all hang out. And it's really funny to see those things happen. And then of course, like, you know, they broke up and, you know, there's lots of drama.
Yeah.
But I feel like the food world too really lends itself to these really tight, sometimes explosive relationships and maybe the personality types that are drawn to it. So it's always an adventure.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like you must like never be bored.
No, I say that like that every day. Yeah, I know. Every day there's something broken or some huge, you know, drama with someone or something. And yeah, it is exciting. And there's always constant challenges too. So, you know, and a lot of times I'm not ready for them. So that, own your own business. Never be bored ever again.
Do you have any hobbies?
You know, someone asked me that yesterday. Oh, the chiropractor, because I have a pinched nerve. And I was like, well, I have a dog. And I go to yoga twice a week.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I'm really working hard on the outside of work hobbies thing. I'm trying to like hang out with my few friends that are not work friends and the person I'm dating. I like hanging out with him. So, yeah, but I know everyone, you know that Marley Grace wrote this really great book, How to Not Always Be Working?
Mm-hmm.
3 different people have given me that book.
Okay.
So yeah. I'm working
on
it.
I might need to borrow a copy.
Yeah, well, I have lots.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, balance is still a big problem, but I really I really love what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And the thing about my job, too, and any entrepreneur, is that there's a million different parts of it. So if I'm bored doing one thing, there's just a lot of other things to do that are very different.
I feel that way about my work because I feel like I am always working, but I'm very rarely doing the thing I probably should be doing.
Yeah.
I'm like, I think of myself as like the most productive procrastinator. So I
get
like
so
much done, but I'm not actually doing the thing I probably should do today. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's such a challenge of working for yourself is how do you conquer that? I know. I have a little trick for that where I tell myself, you know, if there's something I have to get done that I don't want to do, that I can do that or nothing, because nothing is my ultimate fear.
Oh my God,
you know, I can do that or I can sit and look out the window.
Like, mm-hmm.
And that has really helped me.
I might use that.
But yeah, it's good.
2 final questions. 1 I ask everyone and 1 is particular for you.
Okay.
So that one first. What's your favorite chocolate?
Oh, okay. My favorite chocolate is one that not a lot of people buy. It's a smoky corn on the cob bar.
Oh, we've had that before.
Oh, nice.
It's really
Did
cool.
You like it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like campfire-y.
Yeah.
And I love corn.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's, I literally went to a campfire that a friend of mine had and we were talking about corn and she was like, you should make a chocolate with those flavors. And then I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. It has smoked sea salt, sage, smoked pepper, and corn.
Yeah,
see,
and
now
I feel like
I don't make the chocolates, it's hard for me to remember.
And it's also like there's something so like meaty about
it
with all that stuff you just described. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which
I
is
like
sort
that
of
one.
Funny for like a vegan chocolate. It's like so like,
well, I think
satisfying.
We always are trying to make really savory things.
Yeah.
I think because of that like little chip on our shoulder or my shoulder of like that vegan food isn't hearty, you know. So I tend to go like way too far to the other side.
Yeah.
Okay,
and then my last question is, what was your favorite thing to eat when you were growing up? First thing to come to mind.
It's so funny that you say this because as I was driving over, this is kind of long, but I was literally thinking about this. And I was thinking about how, like, I think so many food people have these foundational childhood food moments, and all of mine are so wrapped up with like sadness. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But yeah, and that yeah, I think it's a really common question for a good reason that, you know, these things form you. But because I was literally thinking about this an hour ago, I think one of my favorite things was my grandmother, my dad's mom, lived in a trailer like half an hour away, and we'd go visit her, and she would make chili mac, which was like Kraft mac and cheese with a can of chili. And I just love that.
Yeah.
I want to make it at the cafe, but with our like super fancy,
with your mac
cashew mac and cheese. Yeah. And like, but those, delicious. You know, yeah, I think it'd be really good. Yeah, chili mac.
You wrote also really beautifully about her and like the food she would make and everything. And
yeah.
Chili Mac.
Chili Mac.
There we go. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And
thank
I appreciate
you.
Your time. And I know you've got a lot going on. So
well, thanks, Julia. I love your work so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Want to know more about Great Jones? Let's hear it from the founders themselves.
I'm Sierra Tischgart. I'm one of the founders of Great Jones.
And I'm Maddie Mollis. I'm the other founder of Great Jones.
We launched with 5 pieces of cookware and a mix of materials, and our goal is to make high-quality cookware more accessible and make you proud to cook at home.
Who is Great Jones named after?
It is a nod to a woman named Judith Jones, who was a cookbook author and editor who championed the work of Julia Child, Edna Lewis, James Beard. She really helped define what we consider now to be American cooking and brought great diversity to American cookbooks. She also, interestingly enough, pulled Anne Frank's manuscript out of a reject pile. She's amazing. We wanted to make her legacy known. And it's a nod to the street as well. We're based in New York. We are very proud to build this company in New York, and it's a great street.
Who's Great Jones for?
We always say you're cooking if you are making an omelet in your pajamas. So we really want to spotlight the home cook. When you take pride in the tools that you cook with, hopefully you'll be motivated to cook even more frequently.
For more about Great Jones, head to greatjones.com. Remember that one of their pots or pans is a gift that lasts a lifetime, and you can even get one of their stainless steel lids engraved. For 15% off of any purchase on greatjones.com, use the code CALM. That's C-A-L-M. It's now time to answer listeners' questions about cooking. If you have a question for me, you can always DM me on Instagram at Tertian or send an email to keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com. And now my wife, Grace, who's sitting next to me, is going to answer. She's not going to answer. She's going to ask the questions on behalf of the listeners. You can answer if you want.
On that note, your first question comes from Cheers, y'all, who says, what's the deal with total time listed on recipes? It seems like no matter how efficiently I try to cook, it always takes me way longer to make every recipe than it says. And I'm a seasoned home cook. Is it because the recipe assumes I'm starting with mise en place? And when would I have done that? Am I just terribly slow? Any tips for getting dinner on the table faster without compromising on cooking from scratch?
So I am going to call BS on cooking times on recipes. I think they're just so, like, not useful. And they do assume that you've done all the prep work. So when the ingredient list says, you know, 1 onion chopped, 2 carrots, you know, peeled and chopped, 3 garlic cloves minced, and then it says the total cooking time for the recipe is, say, 30 minutes. It's 30 minutes after you've chopped that onion, that carrot, minced that garlic. And to me, those things are all part of cooking the recipe. So I think those times really kind of make a lot of home cooks feel like they're not fast enough. They're doing something kind of inferior. And I hate that feeling. So that's part of why I don't put times on my recipes. Also, we don't always cook all at once. Like, sometimes I'll peel a bunch of onions and keep them in my fridge so that I don't have to peel it each time I do a recipe. You know, these things don't always happen in order. So I think it's important to keep that kind of thing in mind. So any tips for getting dinner on the table faster, do that. Do some of your peeling and chopping ahead of time if you use a ton of onions in your cooking. If you love making, let's say, cooked greens with your dinners, clean those greens, chop them up, keep them in the fridge for the week. You know, make a big pot of rice and reheat it throughout the week. Things like that, so you can sort of speed up your cooking without sacrificing any flavor or anything like that.
All right, your next question comes from Appearance, who asks, what is your best comfort recipe?
My first thing that just came to mind is a humongous bowl of matzo ball soup. I think there's nothing more comforting than that. I love chicken soup. I love matzo balls. I feel like they're little like floating hugs. Grace, what's your best comfort recipe after you stop laughing at what I just said?
We ate it last night. Your turkey meatloaf, and we had mashed potatoes left over from our shift at Angel Food. And to me, there's nothing better than like a bowl of mashed potatoes with a ton of butter on them. And so that plus your turkey meatloaf, and you are the queen of a meatloaf. So those things just feel very homey in this like really lovely, comforting way.
I think I'm going to change my Instagram handle to Queen of Meatloaf. I will mention matzo ball soup and turkey meatloaf are both recipes in my last book, Now and Again. I'll see if I have them online. I'll link to them in the show notes, but you can always buy the book. I should just say that. Okay, last question.
Your last question comes from Jen, who is a librarian and asks via email, I am trying to switch to eating whole grains and would like to make the switch to whole wheat pasta, but I've found the ones I've tried to be gritty or gluey. Do you have any recommendations on brands or cooking techniques?
So I think the best brand of whole wheat pasta that I've tried, and there's plenty I haven't, but the best I've tried is the one from Trader Joe's. I think it's great. But I would say in general with whole wheat pasta, you really have to cook it through. I think, you know, pasta, you want al dente, you want it to be not, you know, mushy or anything like that. But whole wheat pasta, if you leave it too underdone, it does tend to be really, really gritty. So really cooking it through. So those are all the questions for today. Thank you so much, Grace, for being the voice of the listeners.
Anytime.
And before I head out, a quick shout out to the Woodstock Farm Sanctuary, an organization that Lagusta is a big fan of. The Woodstock Farm Sanctuary rescues farmed animals and gives them care and sanctuary, and they also advocate for animal rights in alliance with other social justice movements. They envision a peaceful world rooted in respect and justice for all living beings. For more about them, head to woodstocksanctuary.org. The link is also in the show notes. And don't forget to head to my Instagram post about this episode, the one with the photo of Lagusta and her dog, for a chance to win one of 5 copies of Lagusta's cookbook. Thanks for tuning into this episode of Keep Calm and Cook On. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you have a few extra seconds, please rate and review the show. It really makes a difference to help others find it. And let someone know about it. Post about it on social media, text a friend about the show, email your family. It all adds up. Keep Calm and Cook On is produced and hosted by me, Julia Tertian, and engineered by David Tatasciore. For more about David, head over to davetat.com. And for more about me and my work and my cookbooks, head over to juliatertian.com. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Tertian. Thanks again for listening. This episode of Keep Calm and Cook On is presented by Great Jones. Great Jones is a line of beautiful, last-you-a-lifetime cookware that's priced well and comes in great finishes and colors. To find out more about Great Jones, head over to greatjones.com. And for 15% off of any purchase on greatjones.com, use the code CALM. That's C-A-L-M.